You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to help you plan that unbelievable travel experience. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
In 2022, Team Milk came together by sponsoring female marathon runners for the marathon in New York City. Today, they're more than 20,000 strong. In 2024, Team Milk is making an even bigger commitment to female runners and launching the only women's marathon in the U.S. designed for and by women. The inaugural Every Woman's Marathon will take place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16, 2024. You can learn more and register for the marathon at everywomansmarathon.com.
Hey, welcome to the Long Form Podcast. I'm Max Linsky, and I'm here, as usual, with Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. What's up, dudes?
Hoi.
Hey, end of the summer.
Yeah. I've been up for like 20 hours.
Really?
Yeah. I woke up this morning in Scotland.
What?
And then I'm back here.
Golf?
I played some golf. I didn't go to play golf, but I did play golf. I played the old course.
The old course?
Yeah, birthplace of golf. Most boring podcast intro ever.
This is our new golf podcast.
Long golf.
Long golf.
Evan, I understand you conducted an interview for this podcast this week.
That is correct. I talked to Amy Harmon, who is a writer for the New York Times, who writes these very long, very human-centered stories about science. She's just really great at taking any particular science topic and kind of turning it into a very human story that you want to read the entire long piece in the newspaper. And we've been trying to have her on for a long time.
Yeah, she finally relented.
If you're trying to get people to relent and listen to you, you need to get yourself a newsletter. Oh, that segue was stretched.
No, I liked it. Yeah. Actually, it was perfect.
Tiny Letter makes it simple to start a newsletter, and we thank them, the good people at MailChimp, for their sponsorship. We also thank
Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. Go to squarespace.com, use the code LONGFORM8, you get 10% off.
Here's Evan and Amy.
Hi, Amy. Welcome to the podcast. Thanks for coming. This is, I talked to you about coming on almost when we started it, I think.
It was a long time ago.
And you said, I would like to, but I have some projects in the works. And whenever one of those comes out, then maybe we could do it. And that was a pretty long time ago. So it's great that not only to have you on, but also that the story came out.
I'm happy that it came out. It did come out. Yes, I am happy.
So I first want to talk, before we talk about that story, which a lot of people are talking about right now on Twitter and other places, I just want to talk about what you do at the New York Times. We're at the New York Times, I should say, in one of their soundproof booths. Because it seems, if not unique, there may be other people that have this role, but first of all, do you have a title? What are you described as
here
at the Times?
Yeah, I do have a weird job at the Times. My title, I'm a national correspondent. I'm on the national desk of the Times. And but I've for a long time sort of specialized, or I've written about the intersection of science and society. So, sort of society and American life, science and American life, and technology and American life. And I've done it mostly in long-form projects. And that's what's weird about my job, because most of my, and it's what's, like, great about my job, and I'm so happy and feel privileged to have my job, but it's also, like, what's incredibly stressful about my job, because my colleagues are all churning out many more stories than I am and a year. And so, and here I am, like, working on it. And I'm not in the investigative group where, so we have obviously we have a large group of people who are dedicated to, you know, working on year-long investigations,
right.
You know, where they're going to sort of bring down the government, or you know, they're going to expose some heinous, you know, some bad deeds. But that's not what I do. So I try to do stories that, you know, illuminate some facet of, you know, usually some kind of tension between science and the real people's lives. And I try to do that through narrative storytelling.
And are you exempt from daily reporting or other types of stories? Do you get pulled into other science stories or do they say they know what you do and when the story's ready, the story's ready?
Occasionally I will get pulled into news. Like, you know, I did a bunch of stories on autism. And so like when Newtown happened, I was pulled into that reporting because the, you know, there was some connection with Asperger's syndrome, and but mostly I am pretty exempt, and you know, and it does feel odd, but there are a few other reporters floating around who do projects like this, and you know, once in a while I go to my bosses and I say, like, are you sure that I should be doing this, because you know it feels, you know, weird and it's stressful, and sometimes like my direct boss is a little bit like, I don't know, you know, what are you doing, and then but I have had, like, you know, I had a Dean and Jill have told me that, you know, they want, and actually at one point I said, well, you know, should I be working for the magazine, because I'm basically doing, you know, trying to do sort of magazine-y stories.
Mm-hmm.
But they like the idea of having some of these stories. I mean, like, not, you know, obviously we need to fill the paper, and but they want to have a mix, and they think that these stories, or they have assured me that, you know, this is what I should be doing. So
So let's talk about this most current one just as a sort of way into what types of stories you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And it's about, you know, it's sort of topic-wise about genetically modified food, but really it's a story about one guy. So maybe just talk a little bit about what it is.
So it's a story about the pursuit of what may be the first genetically modified orange. and, you know, when you think about genetically modified food, if you do think about it, maybe, I mean, some people, you know, just don't, it's not really on their radar, but it's been increasingly on people's radar with kind of, you know, just this whole, the whole food movement. And there was a ballot initiative in California last year to try to get food, any food that has genetically modified ingredients labeled. Anyway, it's traditionally been just these big crops like corn and soybeans are genetically modified, and you don't eat that. It's not even corn on the cob that's genetically modified. It's corn that goes into corn syrup, and it's like these sort of invisible ingredients that go into packaged foods.
Mm-hmm.
So oranges are different because they're oranges, and the particular oranges that I was writing about actually would be turned into orange juice, because they're the oranges in Florida, and Florida is the main source of juice, the juice orange crop.
So they have, it's a more sort of direct relationship.
Yes.
You're eating the genetically modified organism directly.
Whole,
in a way,
yeah,
or drinking.
Yeah,
it.
Exactly, yeah. So, I mean, I had been following a little bit of the debate over GMOs is what they're called, and I was interested in it because I was interested in it partly because there seemed to be this, you know, real public outcry against GMOs, or sort of just this impulsive or instinctive feeling, like, you know, I would tell friends I was interested, and they'd be like, oh yeah, GMOs, I avoid them, you know, I try to avoid them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people who are kind of like farmers market health conscious people, but they're you know, when I looked a little bit at the science of it, there, you know, there's really no real reason in terms of health to avoid them. And so it just struck me as an interesting issue, but I wasn't going to write about it. I didn't want to write, and plenty of people have already written about sort of like, you know, here's this debate, and
yeah,
here are these sides.
Yeah.
And so I was looking for a story, and I talked to a scientist about it who sent me a bunch of like clips to read. And one of the clips had to do with, it just made mention that oranges were under attack by a disease in Florida and that there might be something going on there. It was like a little mention in a bigger story that had to do with papaya, genetically modified papaya. But I feel like papaya, and so papaya actually is the only other fruit on the market that is genetically modified. Oh, yeah. But it's like grown in Hawaii and, you know, I don't, it doesn't kind of have the central place in a lot of people's lives that oranges have.
Oh, interesting. So you could have, I mean, that's like choosing a character. It's like choosing the better character.
Yes.
Orange is a better character
yes.
than papaya.
Well, and also oranges were only just happening. So like part of what I try to do in general when I'm choosing these stories is like to choose a story where I think I can, where some of it has already happened, but I can witness, you know, I want my stories to have like a real arc, like a beginning, a middle, and a real end. And some of that is, it's always a gamble. Like, you know, what's the end going to be? You don't know. But I kind of thought, well, oranges were at there. So I called this guy. There was a guy, a company's name was mentioned in this other story. And I actually didn't think that I didn't think they would let me in because it is so controversial.
Yeah.
But this guy, Rick Kress, who kind of became my character, returned my call, the president of Southern Garden Citrus.
So you reached him directly. You didn't have to go through a person who was trying to mediate.
You know, first a PR person called me back.
Uh-huh.
And then she just kind of like asked me a few questions and what was I interested in. And then she just turned it over to him. And it is a relatively small company and he, you know, he's a pretty hands-on guy. And I think that, I explained to him as I, you know, that I saw the story of the oranges as I wanted to tell his story. Like, it wasn't going to be an antagonistic story. Like most of my stories are pretty much all, you know, I find a story that I want to tell and you want to sort of be empathetic to the character and like bring out the character. And so, you know, I thought that his story would be a contribution to the debate over GMOs, but I needed to be kind of close in to tell it well.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I said to him and he agreed.
Did it take much convincing or was it?
I mean, he thought about it for a while and he like at first he didn't, you know, he put me off for a little while and then he said, well, you can come visit, but like it'll be an exploratory visit. So at that point I had to ask my editors, you know, like, do you want to send me to Florida for an exploratory visit? You know, I don't know. But they thought that it could be, you know, it could be a good story. So they sent me to Florida for an exploratory visit. And I think, yeah, so, I mean, it made him feel more comfortable with me. You know, we got to know each other a little better. And then he agreed to kind of go ahead.
And do you think, so I'm really interested in this because I mentioned this when we were emailing back and forth. Like, I've tried to write about some of these, like, same topics that you've written about, including I had a story that I was working on about sort of GMOs that I never did, partly because getting from the general topic into that kind of story is so, so hard.
Yes.
Because those stories can be really boring and the characters can be really paper thin.
Yes.
And do you think that when you found him, you were sort of like, this is my guy? Or in the exploratory trip, you were thinking like, all right, well, it depends on how charismatic this guy is or it depends on what he's really struggling with? Or did you sense that I've stumbled on the one I'm looking for?
I mean, I think that the story of the oranges, like, more than most of my stories, right, are, as you're saying, about a character. Like, you care about the character. You're emotionally connected to the character. I mean, and that was a struggle with this story. I mean, as much as I like Rick Kress, he's a sort of a straight ahead business guy. You know, I start the story with a scene which was like the most emotional thing he really ever told me, which was when he was informed that this disease was found in his orange grove. And it's this, you know, he knew about the disease because it was, you know, decimating crops around the world and they were worried that it was going to come to Florida. And he had just taken the job like a few weeks earlier. And, you know, the guy, his head of the head, the guy who like is in charge of his groves, called him on the cell phone and he said, it's here. And he pulls over to the side of the road. And the fact that he, you know, that he did that he had that emotional reaction, I was like, yay. And I knew I had to start that way because it was like one of the few kind of visceral moments. And, you know, but then he said, you know, he sits like trying to think about what to do. And he's, you know, he's anxious, and you know, and then he says, okay, let's make a plan. And like several people that I had read the story were like, is that, you know, is that all he said? Like, let's make a plan. Like, it's not that dramatic. And I mean, and I asked him several times, and I asked the guy who was on the other side of the phone, you know, do you remember anything else?
Like, are you sure he didn't, a single tear did not roll down his cheek?
Exactly. But, you know, that's who he was, and that's okay, and that's fine. And I guess I felt like I had my story because I felt like oranges were the story. And, you know, and he was kind of like the guy who was trying to save the oranges, and he himself didn't have to be like that charismatic, because I had to make people care about oranges, or, you know, if I think people sort of would just, you know, a lot of people drink. Actually, I don't drink orange juice.
Oh, really?
I like grapefruit juice, but grapefruits are also susceptible to this disease and could be saved.
That could have influenced your reporting in a way that should probably have the public editor take a look at that. And when you arrive at a story like this, are you a person who wants to go, you know, you're going to go read a bunch of scientific papers and try to know everything when you go in? Or do you feel like, because you're approaching it from a narrative perspective, you want to sort of explore the story by reporting it through these people?
I really felt like in this case, and most, I guess almost, I had to do both. I mean, one reason it took so long.
How long did it take, by the way?
I mean, it took a year. Part of the year was not, like I did another story about genetically modified food. I did a story about the efforts to label genetically modified food in California, and I did, and then I had this other story that I mentioned to you that I'm working on that is not done. So mm-hmm. I was kind of going on, like, at some point I had to like leave this one to make sure that I was present at the other one for different scenes and stuff. So I don't know if it's fair to say that this took a full year, but it took a really long time. And part of it was because I didn't know anything about the debate. It's like there's so much history and like acrimony and like, you know, like false accusations that fly. And like I felt like I had to read all these papers. And like, and then every day also, aside from like the scientific papers, like, you know, is it safe? Is genetically modified food safe? You know, is Monsanto, you know, using this to take over the world? What does it mean to have like crops contaminated with GMO, you know, with like, I just, mm-hmm. and if you looked into it at all, you're like, you know, there's all this stuff. And then aside from the background, like every day it is like, it's in the news all the time. So like I would wake up and be like, oh, I have to like read these other five stories that are on the subject that I'm writing about right now.
Yeah.
So, and besides like, then I was going to Florida several times and Texas and like trying to understand the science of the specifics of the science that I was writing about. So, yeah, it was a lot.
And with this type of story, so you've I mean, in the story, there's this suspense that builds around this creeping disease and then, you know, his efforts to try to, you know, find different scientists to explore what the possibilities are and, you know, develop the trees that will be resistant. And it's sort of all headed towards this point. But how did you decide when to cut it off and say, okay, this is the point at which I have an ending, I'm ready to tell the story?
Right. I mean, I thought, I guess one thing that changed for me in the course of reporting is that I thought that it would happen faster. Mm-hmm. So part of the year was a little bit like, okay, like when am I going to have the ending? But because he started out with these five scientists, you know, I interviewed them all, I understood them all. It was pretty interesting that, you know, that there were these different ways that you could use a gene from another organism, animal or bacteria or plant, to try to help the orange fight off this bacterial disease. And he was going to choose one. And then when he chose his one to go forward, he was going to, like, it was going to become public, and he's going to have to file an application with the USDA to test them and with the EPA. And so I actually thought that somewhere along the way I would witness some conflict. Mm-hmm. like I chose it partly because I thought, oh, oranges, GMOs, like people are going to hear about it, and I'm going to like be able to tell the story of a direct, you know, direct. I mean,
like a meeting where people are shouting at him or something.
Yeah, I mean, there are, you know, people like pretty regularly rip up field trials of genetically modified crops, and you know, or at least protest them. Or so, and this was happening, and it did happen like in England while I was reporting the story, or it happened in New Zealand, or it happened in like other places of the world, but not in Florida. So
you should have tipped off some activists. Hey, do you guys know this is happening?
But the thing that happened that I didn't know was going to happen, that kind of provided the tension that I was looking for, was just this sort of the rise of the popular movement against GMOs. I mean, that, you know, there was like this march against Monsanto, which had, you know, like hundreds of thousands of people around the world, or the labeling efforts in, I think it's like 17 states or more than 17 states, and the first two states actually passed laws that would require any genetically modified food to be labeled. And labeling is a little bit different than just opposing the food, opposing GMOs completely, but it's kind of a proxy for that. It ends up being. So he was facing that, that kind of cultural, you know, rise of this sentiment against GMOs. And that helped provide. Also, the other thing that helped provide the tension, what I kind of witnessed, which I didn't know that I would, but was his growing realization of the difficulty of his task. Like not the science so much, but the he started out kind of cocky. I mean, sort of like, you know, we're orange juice. You know, like yes, I understand that there's been this history of GMOs where people are nervous about this stuff, but like this is orange juice, and it's going to be tested and we're going to be fine. And his kind of like growing realization that he had to care more about public perception than he did about science almost.
Hi, this is Max. I am being that guy at the party, the annoying guy, the schmuck who walks up to two people who are having a really interesting conversation and immediately interrupts it. That's me. But I've got a decent reason. I want to tell you about our sponsor. It's Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off, you can go to squarespace.com. Use the offer code LONGFORM8. I used Squarespace for the first time a couple weeks ago. It took me like, I don't know, 20 seconds or something to set up a personal website. It really is super easy. Their templates are all really clean and nice and minimalist and exactly what you're looking for. If you run into any snags, and you probably won't, but if you do, they've got great customer service. They win awards for it. Go check them out, squarespace.com. Use LONGFORM8 at the end. You'll get 10% off. I'm going to slowly step back now. Here's Evan and Amy.
I felt like that was one of the things that was very compelling about this as a story about this topic, because you have a character who's also kind of learning about it. Like, he's not a scientist. And he's not even apparently like totally familiar with the public debate that's growing around him. And so not only does he have to solve the problem, he's sort of realizing, oh, even if we solve the problem, it may not get accepted.
Yes, exactly.
Public.
And it did get to a point, and this is something that we debated about whether to put in the story. And I wish that we had, but so he'd agreed to do this story with me. So which in a way shows his confidence. Like, he's like, yeah, I'm going to have a big story in the New York Times about this. That's cool. And then at some point, at the point in the story where it's actually he reads the outpouring of hostility about the idea of genetically modified apples. There's a genetically modified apple in the works that's kind of a little bit ahead of him, and which I didn't choose to follow apples, actually, because the particular type of modification is different. So they're turning off the genes that cause apples to turn brown when their cells are damaged, which is a little different than what they were trying to do with oranges, which is basically the orange crop will be, you know, it is on track to be wiped out and by a bacterial disease. And there's no, like, they've tried everything to control the disease, you know, pesticides and tearing trees out and finding another tree, like finding a natural mutation somewhere in the world, but there isn't one. There isn't a tree that's resistant. So they've tried all these things, and the only thing that they can think of really to fight the disease is putting a gene that can fight the disease from another organism into the orange. So anyway, he gets to this point where he's observed all this kind of growing anger or growing hostility in the public. And then he reads this outpouring of hostility on the like the website of the USDA. And he called me up and he was like, you know, I don't know if I can do the story.
Really?
You know, like, this is months into the story. And I was just like, well, let's talk about it, you know. But to me, that was his, that really was the moment of his realization that, like, oh, this public perception thing is a really big deal.
Oh,
maybe having a story in the New York Times isn't such a good idea.
Yeah. I mean, that's real tension, too. I guess it's hard. It's a little bit meta.
It's too, like, self-referential.
Yeah.
Or that was the decision that we came to.
And so when you deliver this story, I mean, you've mentioned that you are, even from, like, the highest up people, you're sort of like given the freedom to do this and the confidence this is something they want. But when you write a piece like this and turn it in, do you face tension with your editors between a more newspaper-like approach to the story? Like, they want more up top, they want more of you laying out the story and less sort of like, we're going to build towards something?
No, I didn't in this case. I mean, there's always the question of the nut graph, right? There's like this, there is a newspaper, especially newspaper, and I don't know in terms of about magazines because I haven't really written for magazines, but you know, there is a desire to have like two paragraphs where you explain why this is important and what you're going to learn from the story. And some, you know, narrative writers of the paper I know kind of chafe against that. But I actually don't mind the nut graph. I mean, I kind of like knowing what the writer thinks I'm going to, like, up front, a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't want to go on and on about it. But so there's that. But, and I did, I guess we did have a long discussion about how much to give away up front.
Mm-hmm.
So I always don't want to say what the end is, even though, like, that is sort of against, like, a newspaper-y thing. You know,
right, you want to hold it back?
Yeah,
you wanna...
yeah. So there was a lot of, I mean, I probably, that's the graph I rewrote the most times, which is saying a lot because I rewrote every graph a lot of times. But yeah, the like, deciding how to say, like, just how to flash the tension that was coming but not really say exactly what happened.
Uh-huh. And is this type of story, can this type of story get spiked? Like, can it get killed? And I'm just wondering because, like, a magazine writer would have faced this sort of, like, I'm going to turn this in, and they may say, yeah, it turns out not to be right for the mix. But you've worked on this for a year, and, you know, this is your job here. Do they also give you the confidence that, like, we're going to run something out of this?
I'm always terrified that they're not going to run it.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't think that they would, like, not run it at all, but they could say, you know, cut it down to 1,100 words,
right.
You know,
right.
They could radically reduce its scope and ambition. And I'm always afraid that that's going to happen. And there's always that moment where you give it to. So I work with, you know, one editor here, and then we have to give it to Dean and Jill. And, you know, you never know how they're going to feel about it.
I guess we should say that's Dean McKay.
Dean McKay and Jill. He's the managing editor. And Jill
Abramson.
Yeah. And you know, we try to tell them all along, like, what they're getting, so that's not a surprise. And they definitely bought into it early on. And I really tried in this case especially to explain the politics of this story because it's complicated. Like,
mm-hmm.
It's a legitimate story just to tell, you know, but we already had a front page news story on the fact that Florida's orange crop is being hit by this terrible disease and, you know, it's declining and, you know, growers are upset that there are losses and, you know, so that's news. And
mm-hmm.
We had that in the paper. So this story really was a story about GMOs, like what, you know, is there a situation in which genetically modified organisms, you know, can be a good thing? And sort of what does this say about the general impression that a lot of the public has that, you know, they're scary?
Yeah.
And since, you know, we've had the paper's major food writers like Mark Pittman and Michael Pollan, who writes a lot for the magazine, have been fairly critical of genetically modified food. So I wanted people to understand that this story was going to try to challenge preconceptions, like negative preconceptions. And they understood that.
Which means that you also knew going into it that there was going to be a reaction. I mean, you were dipping into an area that people feel very passionate about, sometimes based on knowledge and sometimes based on fear, maybe not. But so it did garner at least some of that reaction, including from Michael Pollan himself. And I'm curious what your take was on that.
Yeah, Michael Pollan tweeted a really insulting tweet, actually, and I'm like, Michael Pollan suggested that I had parroted industry talking points. Mm-hmm. He tweeted something that said, you know, something like vague, like interesting New York Times story or important NY Times story. In Twitter, so it's like the numeral two, too many industry talking points, and then, you know, but raises questions, and then he like raised some questions that I actually didn't think the story did raise. I was really upset about it because it was really it's just like, you know, he's basically saying I didn't do my homework, and this is a story that I had spent like a year, like waking up every morning, like with a pit in my stomach, thinking like, I have to make sure I check this. I have to make sure I check this. Like I had, I really knew what I was talking about, and he was suggesting that I didn't. And then he also just didn't, he declined to elaborate. Then it was like, other people actually before me were like, what are you talking about? You know, it was nice that, you know, there are a bunch of other science reporters from different organizations. I mean, like, you know, Forbes and The New Yorker and all these people who I really respect as science writers were like, what are you talking about? You know, Amy wouldn't do that. Or, you know, some of it was just personal, but some of it was also, I mean, and scientists, I should say. So, you know, there were people who were saying, well, you know, what are you talking about? Like this story. And I said, look, this is a story about oranges. It's not a story about, it was very specifically not a story about Monsanto. Like that was part of the story, was that, you know, people associate GMOs with these, you know, with Monsanto and big, you know, corporate food and all of this. And this was like, you know, I mean, Rick Kress's company, it's a company. It's not like, it's not a, like he's not a farmer, but he's not a big biotechnology company either. I mean, he cares about saving oranges because he wants to like continue to be in business with oranges.
Right. His industry is actually a different industry than the industry talking points for GMO would be something coming from people who are developing that stuff. Like, themselves.
Yes. Yeah. Right. So, I should say, you know, I also think he's great. I think his much of his writing and reporting has been great and enlightening about, you know, the food industry, and he wants to, you know, reform agriculture, all for sustainable agriculture. But I think that in this case, I actually think he undermines his own cause because he is wrong on the science, or he is like vague and misleading and or sort of like plays on people's fears about, you know, oh, GMOs sounds scary, but even though there's all this evidence that they are fine. Mm-hmm. And like every scientific body, you know, independent scientific body in the world has said, you know, the ones on the market now are safe. There's nothing intrinsically dangerous about putting a gene from one organism into another, and we can test it. And like, there's just, it's the scientific consensus is so strong on it that to like pretend that it's not is, I find it troubling. And I at least just wish he would engage in the discussion.
Do folks here encourage you or even, I mean, is there a feeling that once you do a piece like this, you know, it's going to be out in the world, you're going to get reactions from people that they want you out there defending it? Or is that more of a personal thing that I'm going to go out and defend my work? I mean, including against, you know, writers who also write for the New York Times or at least the magazine. I mean, a colleague basically.
Yeah.
Do people pay attention to that here, or does that feel like something that's happening in your own world that's more about you?
It's kind of weird. Yeah, there's not really. I don't know how much they know about it because I don't think like the senior editors of the paper are really like creatures of Twitter. So a lot of it is going on Twitter, and maybe that's, you know, just kind of like its own closed chamber. But it is really, Twitter kind of is a public right? I mean, there are all like there. So there are people arguing, but there's like lots of people reading them. And so I, you know, I do feel like I have to go. And I mean, he basically just, you know, challenged my professional integrity. I mean, it's just, and so of course I have to defend it. And I was happy that other people defended it.
Yeah, you had like a posse of people who jumped on it as soon as it happened. Well, I mean, that I was going to ask you actually a little bit about your background, because do you have a science? Do you have a background in science?
No, I don't. So that's another reason why all these stories take me a really long time. Like, I've chosen to write about this intersection of science and society, which, you know, which I think, like, I mean, a lot of science writers don't write about so much, even though, I mean, they write, you know, and I had, like, science writers that I really admire who just are great at explaining, you know, just science, like the scientific discoveries and why they're important in the field of science. So, you know, I do think there's other genre which I try to do, which is more about like how it affects people's everyday lives. But to do that, I do really need to I need to speak to so many scientists for so long who I don't quote.
So you're sort of studying up on each.
Yeah, I need
each
to
bit of science that's part of a piece.
Yes, and so I like if I had the background, it probably would be easier. But scientists are pretty generous in that way with their time. I mean, although it's sometimes harder than others to get scientists. Especially, I try to be upfront about it now. Like, I try to say, like, you know, this story is a narrative story about a particular, you know, protagonist or a subject. Like, I'm probably not going to quote you. I used to do it after and be like, you know, I would send these emails like, thank you so much for, you know, you really informed my thinking on this subject, but I'm sorry I wasn't able to quote you directly. But now, like, I know I'm not going to quote them, and I don't want to mislead them. So you know, and sometimes it can be hard. But I will say, like, on this subject, GMOs, like, scientists, not even scientists who are like engaged in doing genetic engineering, but just like every biologist that I talk to, like, cares a lot about it, because they do feel like the public is like misled about it. Mm-hmm. And so it was not hard to get scientists to talk to me for this story.
So how did you end up doing science? Did you start at the paper doing other types of local national reporting?
Yeah, well, I graduated from the University of Michigan in 1990. Mm-hmm. And I was like, and so I started
in journalism with a journalism degree.
No, I didn't do journalism. I was in American culture. I worked at the Michigan Daily. That's how I started, the student newspaper. And I was the editor of the opinion page. So I wasn't even really like there to try to like train to be a journalist. I was just there to like write political things. But then I thought I would go back to graduate school in like sociology, but I got a job to pay the rent, really, just as a researcher in the Los Angeles Times Detroit Bureau.
That's a thing that does not exist anymore.
It doesn't, no. But cars are still very important in Los Angeles. So they had someone there to cover. It was like the auto industry.
Oh, interesting.
So I like did. I knew a lot. I got to learn a lot about cars, which I was not interested in at all. But it was instructive, and I and then the LA Times actually hired me, like they moved me to LA. So I was just kind of attached to the business desk of the LA Times. And when I got there, this is like a long way of telling you how I got into science writing. But my only skill, having been like the first class at Michigan to be assigned an email address, was that I knew how to use email at the LA Times.
Really?
So at the LA Times at that time, there were no computers were connected to the internet. You had like, it was working on a mainframe with these dumb terminals. It sounds like I'm so old. I am so old. But I was using email to stay in touch with my college friends. And so I borrowed a laptop from their tech people and like put a phone line, you know, like with a 2600 baud modem or whatever, at my desk, and they were like, "Wow, that's really cool! Like, what is that?" And so that was how
she's talking
started
on the computer.
and I gave them like their first tour of the World Wide Web, I started writing about technology and society. Like, it was more, you know, sort of how, and like your parents coming online eventually. Like, I used like all these sort of early internet stories. And again, because I was attached to the business desk, but because technology was kind of, that's what it was thought of at the time, but I really wasn't writing business stories. And then, like, later at the Times, it just kind of segued into I wanted to do science too. Or, you know, I did a series of stories about genetic testing, which...
A series that won the Pulitzer Prize, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, it did. So that was... But that it had, like, a similar kind of angle, which was, like, this science stuff, like, just like the internet was used to be in, like, the province of scientists and laboratories and academics, and now this, like, genetic stuff was filtering out of laboratories, and the human genome had been sequenced and, like, into people's lives where they could use these tests to learn about their ancestry or to make medical decisions. And what was that like, and what were the challenges?
That's interesting. In some ways, it sort of, you don't need a science background, because what you're actually reporting on is how these things are starting to find a mainstream foothold. And so you're, like, on the cutting edge of being an ordinary, untrained person who is learning about them before everyone else and then trying to tell them what's happening.
That's a nice way to put it.
So you won the Pulitzer, but you got two Pulitzers, but one's with other people. Which one came first?
The one with other people came first. So that was also sort of out of the technology reporting that I was doing. The Times had a series about how race is lived in America, it was called. And they assigned a bunch of reporters to different parts of life. So somebody went to a church.
I remember that series,
went to the army. And they wanted a business setting, and it was also like the internet boom. I mean, this is like in 2000. So I was drafted to participate in that. And I followed these two entrepreneurs. One was white and one was black. They were partners, and it sort of showed their different paths and how race affected, their paths.
Mm-hmm.
So that was that one in Pulitzer. I was part of the team that won that.
And usually, I mean, journalism awards are usually really boring to talk about, because most of them are kind of like fake awards that no one cares about, that people get to say I'm an award-winning journalist. But the Pulitzer is an exception, because essentially for the rest of your career, you have a little thing that attaches to your name almost everywhere that someone, says your name. But I am curious, just without going too far into it, I mean, when you got one on your own, is that part of what carved out this ability for you to do these features, or are they sort of like a dime a dozen around here that people are sort of, that guy has a Pulitzer too? Like,
no, that I think that definitely gave me like the capital to say, you know, okay, I did this. And the stories, so that was a series of 10 stories that were done in one calendar year, although I worked on one of them for the previous year. I always like to, I like to try to tell people how long it takes.
Yeah.
Because I feel like these narrative stories, they just take a really long time. So I don't want to like pretend that it only took 6 months.
Right.
So,
just cranking them out.
So the two stories in that series, one was about a young woman who tested positive for the gene that causes Huntington's disease.
I just went back and read that one. It's hard to read though. That disease is also really horrible.
It's a really terrible disease. But part of the point of that story, doing that story, was also to say, like, here's like the most extreme example of what you can learn from your DNA. You know, it's definitive. Like, you will, you know, unless you die of something else first, if you have this gene, this gene variant, you will get the disease, and it's a terrible disease. Most genetic information is much more iffy. Like, it's, you know, like you have a higher probability of cancer if you have such and such gene, or, you know, and you may never get it, or, you know. So I just, yeah, I wanted to use that as the example of the kind of the worst case scenario, but also like what you could really learn. And because I thought everybody would soon be experiencing bits and pieces of that. And so Katie Moser, who I read about then, it was really about how do you cope with this knowledge? And I feel like we're all going to like have to start coping with some of that bits and pieces of that knowledge. Anyway, that was really my first real narrative, like, mm-hmm. that I did on my own. The Race Project kind of taught me that, like, what a narrative was. That was also a narrative, but it was much more like editor driven, and so this was sort of on my own. And until then, I had mostly done like news features. Mm-hmm. You know, I did like trend stories, and they were like interesting and kind of in depth, but they weren't like a story about a protagonist who changes through the story and like comes to some kind of different ending. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, this is a good, this, I like doing that kind of story. Like it was, the other story in the DNA series that was like that was another young woman who had a tested positive for the BRCA gene that raises the, so Angelina Jolie famously just actually went through exactly what the person that I had written about went through. And she decided to have a prophylactic mastectomy. Mm-hmm. But she had all this tension with her mother. So it was also like a story about what DNA, what genetic information can do to families, because, you know, her mother also had passed on this gene to her and had had breast cancer, but didn't have that information early enough to even consider whether to have a prophylactic mastectomy. And she like was worried for her daughter, didn't want her daughter to do it. Was her daughter, she was 33, she wasn't married, you know, she worried like she wouldn't be able to find a man, or she wouldn't, you know, she wouldn't be able to nurse mm-hmm. her children. And so there was so that story also was trying to illustrate this broader issue of what those kinds of tensions, what this knowledge can cause, these kinds of tensions and ripples in families. Anyway, those stories, because they were like actual narrative stories and they took a long time, I could then say after like I got that prize, which, you know, they do care about here, you know, let me try again.
That's
you know?
Worth it. Yeah. There's a payoff for this. What's your relationship to those subjects? I mean, you've written other pieces about people with ALS, people with cancer, and, you know, people with Asperger's or autistic. What do you keep these people? Do they stay in your lives? I mean, they're different. It's different than a normal newspaper story.
Yeah,
in that way too.
Yeah, I would say all of my people are in my, like, I am in touch with, and like, I mean, I don't talk to them every day, but they are, you know, they are definitely, I keep up with them because I'm in their lives for so long and so intensely. I mean, it's not always like, I mean, the Katie Moser, the woman with Huntington's, that was a year long story also, almost a full year. And Deb, who had the BRCA gene, was maybe 4 months. But yeah, it's kind of an intense kind of reporting. It's an intimate kind of reporting. And so, yeah, I talked to, actually when the Angelina Jolie thing happened, I talked to Deb, and we did a little follow up here about where she's at.
Right,
she's married. She has 2 kids. She's good.
And the sort of themes of these stories, when sort of I was looking at a lot of them and reading a lot of them, and there's this, it's such a contrast to the way that science is often reported in this sort of like, here's a discovery and here's what it could mean. There's like a lot of promise in it. And your stories always have this intersection of, especially towards the ends of it, I mean, there's a lot of frustration because there's this promise and there's someone sort of struggling to like connect with the science in a way that's going to help them. But a lot of times they don't, or they don't know what the outcome's going to be, or the outcome is a frustrating one because the science really doesn't deliver.
Right.
Is that the kind of story that you're looking for?
I'm not looking to sort of expose science as like not, you know, like problematic, or, and I'm not looking to celebrate it. I mean, but I think there is a lot of, you know, it can be double-edged, you know, like just, I mean, specific genetic knowledge can certainly be double-edged. I mean, I think we have to like, I mean, often the science kind of outpaces where our like culture is in terms of grappling with it, with the implications of it. And it's true with GMOs too, in a way. I mean, there's part of the problem with, you know, part of the reason for like this widespread kind of fear about GMOs is just that people don't understand what it is. And so some of the stories I'm just like, I'm looking for an emotional way or like a vehicle through which to get people to read about it. Like it's like an excuse to talk about the science, but not to just explain it. I mean, I just think there's great explanatory science. So I don't want to say, I feel like my contribution, what I can do is try to tell a story that will engage people in the story. And then like, they'll realize at the end that they learned a little bit about the science.
for the autism pieces, that seemed, you know, particularly true. There's a lot written about autism now, and some of it great, and about, you know, people are studying and trying to figure it out, and then there's the whole vaccine thing happening. But those stories, the kid who's trying to sort of like get a job as an animator and sort of like make his way as an adult, and then the couple who are both have Asperger's and are sort of navigating a romance. I mean, those stories almost they just seem like stories about people in a way. They're not actually totally about the topic in a lot of ways.
Yeah, I mean, I guess with the autism, the first one about Justin's young man who was in high school, his final years of high school, and it was about, you know, whether he would be able to get a job and kind of integrate into society after high school, because, you know, there's the law requires schools, public schools, to kind of take care of kids like him through high school and even, like, you know, an extra year of high school. And then, but then kind of that's it. There's mm-hmm. no afterwards. There's no, I mean, there's some support for kids like him, but there's no, like, promise of, like, actual, like, join the world. And so, yeah, and the science of that was kind of like in the background of that story was almost like just the ability to better identify people like Justin as children, and the better treatments and better interventions that exist for them now. And so that's great. So, okay, like, we've done something there. You know, we've realized that autism isn't caused by, like, bad parenting, and we've realized that, you know, there are certain types of treatments that can be useful. But, you know, then, okay, so now what do we do with people like that? And there was some, like, I also just sometimes I try to put the science in the links.
Like, oh, really?
I just like there's also the whole, like, what causes autism debate, which isn't really a debate, but you know, it was relevant a little bit to as it was to many families who just wondered, like, what caused my child, you know, what caused this to happen. And so in kind of the history part of his childhood, I didn't want to get into that debate, because that's also, it's similar to the GMO thing. Like, it's the oranges story was criticized, besides the pollen critique, which is like, oh, you're too, you know, you're parroting the industry. There was, like, another critique from this guy at the Knight MIT Media Tracker who was like, oh, you didn't give Monsanto enough response. And so, you know, I was like, okay, well, which one is it, you guys? But like, I didn't want to, and I embedded some of the debate in links also in the GMO story, because if you're telling a story, you got to tell the story. Like, and so you can't digress into every little, you know.
Right.
I tried. I mean, at some point, I did have a much longer draft of both of those stories, in which all of that was there.
But that makes me wonder about something else, which is, when you're writing these stories, do you feel like you're writing them for the web and not for the paper?
I mostly do now.
Really?
I really do mostly, which I shouldn't say, because the paper is still what, like, the people who buy the paper pay us.
Including myself. Yeah, buy the paper. I read it. And I read all those stories in the print, although I went back and checked out, because the GMO one has, like, some multimedia stuff in it.
Yes.
Actually, the autism one had multimedia stuff in it,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, I do think more about the web audience now. But I also like to see it in the paper. And we are still, like, it's so interesting, because really the length is decided by the, like, it you know, my story was, it started on the front, this is the recent one, and then it was 2 pages inside. And so that is, like, a defined length. And so that's, you know, because with the web you could write it much longer, but.
Yeah. And related to the, I think it's related to those, the autism and Asperger's story, you're working on sort of at least a loose concept for a book of some sort, or at least you're gathering string on something, which I feel like I can talk about because you've publicly asked people to, like, send you things. So talk about a little bit of what that's about.
Yeah. Well, one thing, I guess, so the other, one reason I was thinking about length, actually, is because, so the second autism story, which was about a couple, both of them had Asperger syndrome, and it was kind of like, you know, what is it like to try to have an intimate relationship when, you know, the main thing that defines your neurological condition is that you can't sort of put yourself in someone else's shoes. And they, you know, I spent some months with them, like, following what their struggle to do that. And that story was, the Times is starting to do these ebooks, so they asked me to expand. So that story was 5,400 words, because mm-hmm. it was also started on the front, and it was 2 pages, and that's the length of 2 pages with some art.
Uh-huh.
And so then, but these, as you know, does the Atavist have, like, certain length, like a window of length,
or just, do you have between 5,000 and 30,000?
Okay, so this was, like, you know, between 10 and 20,000. I was
the
told,
expanded version.
Yes.
And it was New York Times and Byliner.
And Byliner.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I did that. And it was interesting to be able to expand the story because I had all the stuff that I would have liked to have said in the first story. But yeah, the other thing is that I'm trying to collect stuff for a book that would focus on the particular interests, like these, they're called perseverations or special interests or the people on the autism spectrum. So people, it's like, it's one of the two defining characteristics of autism, one being, you know, a difficulty with social interaction, and the other is like repetitive or restrictive interests. But I'm fascinated by them because, you know, they, like with Justin, it was, for example, it was animation, the young man that I wrote about, and he just knew everything there was to know about every animated show and like all the animators. And so I'm interested in what kind of the biology of that. I want to look more at like what is it mm-hmm. about the brain that makes you able to be so kind of obsessive and drill down so deeply, and then also in just how it affects their lives. So I'm kind of collecting those
and it feels
examples.
Like it could be a book.
Yeah, something. Yeah.
All right, well, you have also, we know now, another major project in the works, so you have to come back and okay. talk about that when that's
done. I would
be happy
to. Yes.
All right. Well, thanks very much.
Thanks. It was fun to talk to
you. This.
Thanks.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Longform Podcast. I'm Evan Ratliff from Atavist. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from Longform. Our wonderful editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our intern is Robin Jodlowski. And thanks to Amy Harmon for coming on the show and for the New York Times for hosting us there in their New York Times fancy building. See you next week.
More to-dos, less time, and an infinite number of tools to keep track of. Sometimes doing business has never felt harder, but you don't need a miracle to hit your goals. You can just use HubSpot because their all-in-one customer platform can make growing your business infinitely easier. Imagine this: high-quality leads, fast closing deals, wildly happy customers, and more benchmark-breaking quarters. It's not a miracle, it's HubSpot. Visit HubSpot.com to get started today.